The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Mike Rupert, we're back again with another episode of the Lifeboat Hour in a world that's really, really going haywire, and it's kind of going around the bend. It's kind of losing its mind. There have been some amazing developments this week, but we are on the cusp of a period, I think, where the only word to describe what's going to be happening is berserk. Senseless and mindless stuff. We're going to connect a lot of pieces of that tonight, and there's some good things emerging. There's some good dialogue that's taking place, but there are a lot of very scary things happening in the world tonight. I want to talk about a video that's a clip. It's about a minute and 47 seconds. It's a video that's up on the world news desk at CollapseNet. And it's a video, you're going to hear the audio of this, and it's a guy named Andrew Breitbart, who is one of the conservative 1% talking head paid psychotic dudes out there, and boy did he prove it. This was a video that was taken at the roll-up to the entryway to the Conservative Political Action Committee dinner, I believe it was in Washington. There's several dots that are going to connect with this, but before we play the tape, I'm going to read you what I put up on CollapseNet about it. Breitbart was, when he got out of his car, there were occupiers outside. I don't know how many, from what I could tell, maybe 10, 20, maybe 30, behaving themselves, doing what occupiers do, holding their signs and speaking their minds, and Breitbart just absolutely goes berserk. The tape showed up on Huffington Post. But this is what I wrote about what I'm about to play for you. I can see and feel the signs that absolutely mindless, flesh-ripping violence is close. I just saw a tape of a conservative asshole, Andrew Breitbart, just screaming out of control at Occupy outside CPAC's dinner. He lost it to the point where the cops were restraining him. He was calling occupiers animals, and then it started screaming at some 20s and 30s female occupiers, stop raping people, over and over. He was like frothing at the mouth. And I've seen this before, and this is, I've seen it as a cop, and I've seen it many times in my life. I've seen it in the Rodney King insurrection in Los Angeles. I've seen it in a great many incidents of violence. This is the point just before all connection to reality gets lost. And everything, everywhere, just becomes about ripping flesh. There's nothing to do at this point when you get to that point, but get out of the way. And this was really close. Create distance. All chance to reason or change things evaporates, and it can't be recaptured. I'm going to build a picture for you guys tonight with what you're going to hear. But I'll speak for myself, Michael C. Rupert, here in the nightclub at the end of the world. I'm terrified today, little boy terror. It's the kind of terror that happens, you know, when a child sees his parents, in a bloody fight. His mom comes up with a split lip. The terror that burns the soul, and people like me will do anything to avoid that. This is the terror that scares every cop, because losing it means losing everything. And I apologize for static on the line. We don't know where that's coming from tonight. But all the warrior can do is let the fear eat him or her. But I want you to hear what happened with Andrew Breitbart and the occupiers outside the Conservative Political Action Committee dinner. We're going to roll that tape right now.
Ho, ho, ho. CPAC has got to go.
Go away! Racism, anti-gay! Racism, anti-gay!
Now that was Andrew Breitbart doing all that yelling. You're animals, you're freaks, stop raping people, behave yourself. Did you hear that taunt? And then he, you know, was taken inside, and then he sat down with all of the, all of the Karl Rovian, Sarah Palin types. But now, pair what you just heard with this little vignette, because inside that hall for CPAC were a small number of occupiers, let's say 10, I don't know how many, 10, 20, you can hear them. And while Sarah Palin is up on stage speaking, they start to do what occupiers do in the middle. They interrupted, they started speaking their piece, and as soon as they opened their mouths, it was as if the entire crowd in the audience had been drilled for this, and almost as if a band leader started to hit a cue and said, go. All the members of the CPAC dinner just started going, USA, USA, USA. And it was Nazi-like. It had the rhythm, it had the cadence, and it, of course, overpowered the occupiers who were very much taken aback. Now, take that scene and just move the crowd inside CPAC standing behind Andrew Breitbart as he's doing his rant and they're doing their chant. And you can see that mindless violence is not far behind. Now, what I fear worse than that, and I'm speaking now from my heart to all occupiers, is what would happen in that scenario, and a scenario like that is coming for sure, if the so-called black bloc, the anarchists, the masked ones, were in the crowd of occupiers. You would have an almost scripted Sturm Arbeitlung essay setting for Ernst Roehm and his brown-shirted stormtroopers to go out and commit mass mayhem on the crowd. Now, I put this in the context. On CollapseNet all this week, we have been bringing you increasingly alarming stories about a world that is in flames. And right now, Greece has gone mad. I have been watching videotapes from Athens much of the day today. And I see things that I have never seen before in my life, not insofar as watching Greece or the economic collapse goes. What I see is crowds of people throwing many Molotov cocktails at Greek police, forcing the police back. This is a pitched battle. These people have had enough. And we're going to have videos, selected clips and stories about what's happening in Greece on the World News Desk tomorrow. But that's going on all over the world. Now, there has been a lot of discussion recently. We had on the World News Desk, we had what I thought was an excellent response to Chris Hedges' brilliant piece that I thought, talking about the cancer on Occupy, which is the black-shirted guys, black-hooded guys, who we have known, admittedly, very little about. Someone named David Graeber, I don't know if that's a nom de plume, wrote an open letter to Chris Hedges titled Concerning the Violent Peace Police. And it was wonderful to have first some stakes, some information for me to read to know where these guys are coming from, because we've had no clue about what motivates them. And the article, his letter was well structured. I disagree with much of it, but I understood the heart and the place. From what I saw just before the show tonight, Chris Hedges was caught by a reporter from somewhere on the telephone. I'm sorry, this has been unfolding pretty quickly today. And he was asked about his response to the letter to him, and this dialogue is so important right now. And Hedges made a point that I have to firmly agree with. In the 1960s, now I was alive then, and I lived through those times, when the whole world was a protest movement, there were many, many different groups, from the NAACP to Cesar Chavez's United Farm Workers, to Students for a Democratic Society, to Weathermen, to the Weather Underground, and they were all separate. They weren't cross-contaminated. They weren't polluted. And I do completely agree with Chris Hedges, especially given what I saw with Andrew Breitbart and what I saw inside with Sarah Palin. The last thing that Occupy needs is to give those kind of rabid dogs grounds to attack us. That doesn't mean that we are not on a line and we are not on the same side of the line as the black box block. It does not mean that we oppose them. I do not think that, and there have been confrontations where occupiers, you know, have gotten into altercations with them and have turned them into the police. I also think that's wrong. I think that there are many, many fronts on this. You cannot attribute the positive changes that came out of the 1960s and early 1970s up through Kent State, the end of the Vietnam War, civil rights, as the victory of any one group. It was all those groups working, but they were working separately. And I have great fear in my heart tonight after having watched this stuff and seeing clearly what's going on around the world that we are approaching the period where you lose it of mindless violence, where there's suddenly no more time for talking, there's no more time for thinking, and I fear that moment, a moment, one of what may be many or several along the road to collapse, is very close, and where you're positioned when that happens makes all the difference. We can talk more, and there's some very important stuff about war and warriors, and about how warriors are. I'll talk about my experience and maybe some of the stuff that I've learned from some of the guys who've taught me later on. But it's about containing that point and holding off that moment from when you lose it or go berserk. And the word berserk has a very long historical lineage, and quite often a warrior will tell you, you can't win unless you go berserk. But the warrior's truest art is to contain and channel and control that energy rather than to let it be wasted or inflicted recklessly, and that's a very fine line that we all walk. So I went back today. I'm going to set up a song we're going to play here with this. I went back today to a quote that I put in both Crossing the Rubicon and in Confronting Collapse. The quote's from Frank Herbert's book, Dune. And the quote says, I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. When the fear is gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. So that kind of sets up real perfectly what is probably the best new white trash song of all. It's tough because there's three or four really good ones. But this is the point at which we're at now. And unfortunately for all the years that I've been doing this, one of the greatest curses of being Mike Rupert is that I have gotten to see horrible things years in advance that I now witness coming true, and it is an unusual place to be, and it's quite often not pleasant. But we do what we have to do. We don't ask questions. We just get through this. But there's one prayer, which is, don't let the fear turn my ears and eyes off. Here is, It Would Be Strange. Thank you. Lexicon Wawa guitar here was played by my good friend, our good friend at New White Trash, Michael Yost, J-O-S-T. He's an amazing artist, very widely known, travels the world, one of the best guitar players I've ever heard in my life. That song was It Would Be Strange from New White Trash, www.newwhitetrash.com. That's a band I was in with some amazing, wonderful people and musicians. And, that kind of holds me together, too. So, okay, so all of that out, and being very aware of the amazing tension that's in the air, and that is breaking all over the world. That is, geez, every night on the World News Desk, as I go through the stories for CollapseNet, and thank you all, we really see that we've been doing what you want. Lately, we've seen big jumps in membership over the last week or two. We need that. We still need a lot of money. The cyber warfare that waged against us has caused us to move to a very expensive new server arrangement. We have no idea how we're going to pay for that. You can find out how to help us by going to CollapseNet and clicking on the button Support Independent Journalism, if not or just by membership. It's more than worth it, trust me. It ain't worth half as much as it's going to be worth in 2 or 3 months. Help us out there. But as I go through these stories every day, I see the incidents of really violent, nasty, really angry civil unrest exploding around the world. And it's an amazing context in which to live. So, of course, we look for balance. And I had this amazing experience Friday night of going to see a play locally called Civil Disobedience the Musical. You have to look this up. I should have gotten the website. I apologize. But you know what? If you Google it, I'm sure you can find it. It's amazing cover art. It is a play directed and written by a good friend of mine, Brian Bryson, who I met at Occupy Santa Rosa. He's an amazing filmmaker. And I didn't quite know what to expect. I started getting these notices that there was this play, and I knew that there was a 17-year-old girl who was playing my role. She was speaking my lines and my words, and this is an amazing concept for a play. And the experience of the play itself was just amazing. It's been running around Sonoma County, amazingly hot reviews. Brian's going to make a movie out of this, and we need to stop and say congratulations to Brian Bryson and his wife. I don't know their name, but they had a baby the same night I went to see the play. That was Friday. And welcome, little one. We're trying to make this a good world for you. And so I get out to the play, and one of the biggest leads was in the hospital. The director wasn't there, and it was raining, and it was live. It was theater, and I got so in touch with the fact that this wasn't electronic media. This was interaction with, like, people on a stage, and that's what makes stage good. But anyway, this was not a play about me, thank God. That's enough. But I had a character in with a great many other characters, all played by youngsters and teenagers. There was a Mario Savio character who gave the, you know, put your body against it, you have to make it steady. There was a 9-year-old giving that speech, and there was a character played by Jordan Torres. Torres played the part. He played the part of his grandfather Conrad Knudsen, who marched with Martin Luther King. Karen Sebald. Or Seibold of Petaluma High School played me, and she was good. Boy, that was trippy to watch her in a boney hat. Monica Schaefer, 16-year-old Santa Rosa High, played Sabina Ahmed, a 21-year-old activist, and so it was a wonderful ensemble performance that connected all the generations, especially from the old veteran activists to the young ones. But when you hear the young ones speaking your words, it's an amazing experience. I really hope this play really takes off. There were some amazing performances in there, and I know Brian's got booked. He has the play booked at many more locations throughout West Sonoma County, so it's filling seats. And that was just an amazing experience to walk through, and it was in the midst of all this fear in the world. It was kind of like a glass of cookies and milk, and it was good, because whatever message we're carrying throughout this movement, whether we're Transition or Zeitgeist or CollapseNet or Ron Paul or what, you know, what our message is getting through, and our message does have life, and it will live after us. We've got a couple minutes before we go to the bottom of the hour. When we come back, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read something brilliant by a guy named Derek Jensen. I know that name will be familiar to many of you. We're going to reach out to him next week, try to get him on the show, which is very inspiring, and it's also something very much to hold on to as the turbulence increases. When the puree switch is hit on the whirring blender, it's not possible to control anything, and it's too noisy to have dialogue, so you have to kind of ride that part out. But let's talk about the warrior stuff and about that cycle losing it place where, what's his name, that crazy, hold on, Andrew Breitbart was, you know, behave yourselves, behave yourself, right? When it gets to that degree of disconnection from reality, that's the point when it really gets scary. And having been a police officer in many situations, family disputes like that, and crowd situations, riot situations, when you see that happen, you can feel that trap door open inside of you like, oh, this is like so out of control. So I started thinking about that, and there is something that I have respected, and maybe this is me being old now, getting to understand parts of myself, or parts of what my teachers have learned and gone through, is that quite often you have to reach that level of insanity to survive. Quite often that is the only thing that will determine who walks out of a battle, and I think every warrior, anybody who's been in serious combat, can tell you that. The question is where it's unleashed, how it's unleashed, and how it's controlled. And as I thought about that, I thought about the people who spend a lifetime mastering martial arts. And really, I just had the spontaneous view to realize that what all of the physical training and the mental training involved in any martial arts discipline is to create a vessel that's safe and strong enough that can handle that explosive energy, use it, and channel it in a way that's controlled. Because unfortunately, and I saw this so clearly in Los Angeles in 1992 with the Rodney King insurrection, when it becomes mindless, there's nothing you can do but just get out of the way. But the other part of that is you can't watch the zombie apocalypse too closely. You can't look at that insanity for too long, or else it'll try and suck you in. And that's the real danger. That's from my lifetime of experience, and I have not been perfect at this, believe me. That's at the point when you recognize things going haywire, that your first and only priority is to avoid stepping into that madness. And that's what I'm afraid of. And I'm afraid that as the spring gets here, and that as Occupy continues to present itself, and as the situation in the world gets more desperate, that the situations will be created where it becomes easier and easier for everybody to lose it, and that's the one thing we can't have. And as far as the occupiers go, and I'm, you know, for all of us who have sworn to nonviolence, when we're dealing with the beast in the street, in a public venue, in a public place, we have to embrace and keep that mantle of nonviolence absolutely pure. No distinction between property and violence to property and violence to people, because the law won't see it that way and the matrix won't see it that way. And there's no way to honestly convey any distinction that's being made along those lines. Our chance for victory in this part of the movement, which is part of a change of consciousness, a broader one across the human race, which also includes the black box blocks. It includes Anonymous. It includes anybody who's trying to end this machine. We're all on that side. But it's imperative that we not take away or risk losing Occupy's greatest strength, which is our nonviolence. So that's enough of that sermon, but I really care about this, and I'm really concerned tonight. We're going to go into station break here in just a second. If you want to send in questions or talk about anything, I've got a lot more to talk about tonight, trust me. You can call 1-888-874-4888. Let's talk this out. Let's get down to the bottom of it. We're safe in the nightclub at the end of the world here. You can email me directly at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. And we'll take your questions after we come back. But I'm going to read this when we come back, this amazing new declaration from Derek Jensen. I'm going to put it in context And it's going to become even more important for the role I think something like this is going to serve for it. There's one thing I should add before we go to break, which has to do with our wraparound song tonight. You ready for this? We'll get to the cancer. Okay. We just had ran a story on from the Independent in UK. Lonely, shy, sad. Well, now you're mentally ill too. And anyone now who is presenting anywhere with any of those symptoms is immediately judged mentally ill and put on some kind of psychotropic drug. How crazy does it have to get? I mean, gee, doctor, my leg just cut off. It really hurts. Oh, well, you shouldn't be having that pain. Well, yes, you should. Your leg's just been cut off. People should be, you know, sad, upset, angry, and stuff. And, you know, but no, there's a pill for that, too. So we're going to go out into the station break here with my deep gratitude to PRN. You can find us at PRN.fm. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.org on the web. It's been good to be on this show for a long time, and I put this thing on me every Sunday like a warm blanket. So we're going to take a break, come back, and I'll read you something really uplifting to put a smile on your face. See you in a minute.
Take these, goodbye. Take these, goodbye. Take these, you'll be fine.
When you're feeling down, hello, we've got toys for your mind. Red, white, and blue, yellow, take two of these, and in no time at all, you'll be fine.
Take these,
no time at all, you'll be fine.
Take these,
no time at all, you'll be
fine. Just fine. Everything's going to be just fine. Just eat a couple of these. All right. There ain't nothing wrong. No, man. Nobody should be killed. There's something wrong with you. We can end the song. Fade the song.
It doesn't matter.
Okay. He's playing the whole thing. There we go. We got it. Okay, we have our show back. The control of the Lifeboat Hour has now been returned to me, I think. But that's, you know, it's all an illusion anyway. Okay. An amazing little, you know, talk about the insanity that we see out there. From the Telegraph this week, on February 9th, Britain, it's a true story. I mean, it's a headline. Britain calls on the world to put a price on nature. Yeah. Okay. Britain calls... Every country in the world should measure natural capital as well as GDP in order to create a global economy that values the environment as well as money. Environment Secretary Caroline Spellman will say, "Well, there's an absolute lunatic looking you right in the face, presenting something as an official government policy. Let's put a price tag on fresh water. I mean, as soon as we do that, corporations can go take all the fresh water, bottle it and sell it, commodify it, turn it into derivatives, create scarcities to modify the derivatives, accelerate the use of it to create, or we can do that with fresh air. We can do that with topsoil. We can do that. Yeah. I mean, talk about absolutely, totally insane. I'm going to get to Derek Jensen in a second. We got an early caller, Jonathan from Philadelphia. You got a question?
Hello, Mike.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm alive and kicking.
Good for you. So am I. I've been a ClapSent member probably since the second week you opened it up. I called before. I wrote something, and I want to just go through it real quick. It's something about sports and stuff. A part of our culture that is going to be hard for many to render is worthless. I'm talking about sports, the bread and circuses of this modern crumbling empire. At the local club down the street, zombies gather together to watch the mindless two of the game. They show up in their sports awareness T-shirts that say Eagles and Phillies. They scream and yell, and it means so much to them. If the team that happens to have the same name as the city they happen to live in wins, they go crazy and sometimes run around the streets. There's been several occasions where they've damaged property and caused chaos. While these morons are screaming, yeah, we're number one, these guys who are actually doing the work are making outrageous amounts of money. What the hell is this? How is this sustainable? Why is it okay when Wall Street bankers are making like outrageous bonuses?
Okay doesn't mean anything anymore. It, you know, something either is or it isn't, and this is what is. And of course, it doesn't make sense. And it's dying. I look at professional sports now, man, and I just go, oh man, dead man walking, dead man walking, dead man walking. Let it go.
It's like grown men playing with a ball or stick, and I don't know. It just seems to me so useless.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that, because sport, recreation is important. But then, you know, my favorite sport was always baseball. But, you know, that was baseball when you could go sit and feel the dust in your nostrils and, you know, play it yourself, or you know, it was just...
Yeah, I'm not talking about playing it. I'm talking about just that whole machine.
Okay, well, let's distinguish, because sport's going to be essential for our species to survive. We have to know how to play. If we don't know how to play, recreate, to exercise our bodies, to work... with each other as teammates, that's one of the great things that team sports does, we're going to have a very hard time of it. We can't go all on a total austerity diet here. The human species doesn't work that way.
Yeah, okay.
But the pro sports, it's going, it's gone. It's, you know, it's just, let it die.
There are millions of dollars they spend, like, on the Super Bowl and stuff, and it's outrageous, and people just are programmed, and they just do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, we have. I'm gonna move on after this. Thank you for your call.
Yeah, thank you, Mike.
You brought something up on CollapseNet. I'm assuming most of you have seen it. There is on the yellow bar. That's where I put really significant, meaty things for people to watch. And I just put something new up there called "The Story of Your Enslavement," which is about a 13. It's a brilliant video, and it's just brilliant. And it is pure George Orwell, and how clearly George Orwell saw this, that 7 billion of us are cattle. We have been farmed, because it was discovered by the infinite growth monetary paradigm after Egypt just beat their slaves to death. Roman gave their slaves a little bit of freedom, but the infinite growth monetary paradigm found out that it could be more productive and extract more resources if people believed they were free and were allowed to choose their own occupations. Although it's an amazing video. It's a mind blower. And it touches the anger that comes when we clearly see that almost for all of human history there has been a game underway. I don't know who's coughing. Okay. We have another caller coming in. There has been a game underway in which human beings have been cattle. And that's, we've been had from birth to grave to death. And how many lives have been lived without even an awareness that that was the prison that they were living in? We got a call, Isaiah from Texas. You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, man. What's up?
Yeah, I was calling because I was wondering about, like, the possibility of war with Iran, just because, you know, like, we see the social turmoil, we have peak oil, you know, we have all these problems, you know, the U.S. being insolvent and so on. And I was just wondering, like, does the government or, you know, the power that be, will they just take us all to war just to kind of,
all right,
you know, put an end to all these problems that are just hanging out there?
All right. I'm going to let you take that off the air because I want to get on to read something, but I will answer the question. First of all, the attack on Iran for now is off. Everybody needs to get this. It is so totally off. Around the world, the United States is being humiliated. It is being beaten. It is retreating. And here are the examples. The U.S. and Israel tried to start the World War III. The battle it would have fought it was not engaged, but the war did break out because three Iranian military facilities were destroyed. I think one by space-based weapons, one was blown up. Iranian nuclear scientist was blown up by Israeli agents, and 10 Syrian pilots were hit by a commando team inside their Air Force base. So that was a bloody war, but it didn't take off because the world wouldn't go for it. What happened was Russia made it extremely and abundantly clear, and it's still doing it all this week, all this last week, that it will stand with Iran. It has, and key to attacking Iran has been the regime change in Syria, which is now also off the table. No attack on Iran could take place as long as the Assad regime was in place in Syria, because Syria would really hurt Israel because of its immediate proximity. Hezbollah is there. So they had to get Assad out. Well, Assad ain't going. The Russians have sent Lavrov, their foreign minister, and he was received like the Pope. They sent a military delegation. They've sent ships. They're sending aid. And Russia said, you attack Syria, you attack Iran. It's the same as attacking Russia. China has said the same thing. China just sent a mission to Iran to discuss Iran's nuclear program. The world made it very clear that the U.S., and so the U.S. backed down completely from the attack on Iran. Don't buy the press stories. They want you to be afraid of that for now. Now, these maniacs might come back and try something different, but let's look at what else has happened to the U.S. The U.S. gave an oil embargo, and nobody came. They said, okay, we're going to stop the world from buying Iranian oil, and we'll just make up from it from all the spare excess capacity. Well, first of all, peak oil was proved beyond a shadow of a doubt, because every nation in the world said, no, we're not going along with this. The South Koreans said it. The Chinese said it. The Japanese said it. The Indians said it. France said it. Greece said it. Spain said it. We are not doing without Iranian oil, because what was found was that there is nothing that can replace Iranian oil. But now, in the latest failed grand strategy of what's going on out there in the world, I got to roll through this because I was going to talk about it anyway. The U.S. has tried to economically punish Iran by saying, okay, we're not letting you trade oil. We're shutting off your central bank. No access to dollars. You can't buy oil. Well, what's happened with that, clearly, is that my line feels like it went dead. I hope you all can hear me. Hold on a second. I'm going to check. Okay, so I'm asking the board if they can hear me. I'm still going to talk as if they can. So what the world has said, in effect, is we'll get Iranian oil. We'll just, India's trading now food. Malaysia's trading food. The U.S. Attempt to hurt Iran economically by shutting off its access to dollars has totally freaking backfired. I'm going to read you this quote from a story we're going to have on the World News Desk tomorrow. Dollar going. It's from a publication. It's from the Daily Bell. At Daily Bell, we have them on the World News Desk from time to time. But here's a quote from this article. The dollar has been the world reserve currency since 1944, and the Keynesian-Fabian socialist economic palaver in New Hampshire's White Mountains. They all should have paid more attention to Lord Keynes. Quote, the situation is now gradually getting desperate, which is proven by America's attempt to isolate Iran financially. An effort by Hillary Clinton to choke Iran's economy by financial blackmail has failed miserably. Iran has concluded trade agreements with India to deal in gold, with Russia to deal in rubles, and with China to deal in yuan. And they're going to do rice or some other food crops that come from India. They'll just trade the food for the oil. Those three, by the way, are Iran's largest by volume trading partners. Other nations that are avoiding the dollar are Venezuela, Cuba, and any number of additional South American states. A rice farmer who works for us at Kolasnet, he's just a mainstay on our World News Desk, and we are all so grateful to his day-in and day-out loyalty in sending us these stories from Japan. A rice farmer made a comment. Israel's motives notwithstanding, the main reason the U.S. is trying to crush Iran is not nukes or human rights or whatever excuse to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. I can't stop laughing. But rather that Iran has become one of the big players in the global dollar dump. In the eyes of the U.S., this has always been Iran's greatest sin, as was Saddam Hussein. Greatest sin, the fact that he was going to start selling Iraqi oil priced in euros way back when the euro was something like a viable currency. So the U.S. is in full retreat, and now the world, and we're bringing these stories to you daily on the World News Desk, and I'm commenting on them, how quickly the world is starting to dump the dollar, which means that here in the United States, we look to be, you know, in the inevitable pipeline from which there is no escape toward hyperinflation, which could happen very, very soon. The global revolt, because the U.S. is looking weak. The U.S. is looking weak everywhere, and power is shifting eastward to China and to Russia. The center of gravity on the planet is moving decidedly eastward at a breakneck speed. And so our parents, you know, our government now beats up on us like the drunks who are out in the street who got their butts kicked deservedly by somebody who wouldn't put up with their nonsense. And now they've come home and they're starting to beat up on us. And this dysfunctional family is it's going to get a lot more dysfunctional. Let's put that in. I've got two more emails coming in, but I got to read something to you guys. It's very, very important. In the midst of all this, with a lot of meaty discussion coming out, a lot of really good dialogue, a lot of really good thought and thinking being forced by these events. On February 1, Derek Jensen, who was extremely well known in the peak oil sustainability movement, he has been performing out here eloquently with great style for a great many years. He wrote a declaration. And here's the reason why I think that's important, because as the insanity increases in the world outside and one gets more tempted to be sucked in, Sodom and Gomorrah, don't look back, into that panicked, fevered state, it's important to have something to focus on, to hold on to. So this was a declaration written by Derek Jensen, which was published on the Occupied Wall Street Journal site. We have that up on CollapseNet also. We had that this week. Let me read this to you. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that the real physical world is the source of our own lives and the lives of others. A weakened planet is less capable of supporting life, human or otherwise. Thus, the health of the real world is primary, more important than any social or economic system, because all social or economic systems are dependent upon a living planet. It is self-evident that to value a social system that harms the planet's capacity to support life over life itself is to be out of touch with physical reality. That any way of life based on the use of non-renewable resources is by definition not sustainable. That any way of life based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources is by definition not sustainable. If, for example, fewer salmon return every year, eventually there will be none. This means that for a way of life to be sustainable, it must not harm native communities, native prairies, native forests, native fisheries, and so on. That the real world is interdependent, such that harm done to rivers harms those humans and non-humans whose lives depend on those rivers, harms forests and prairies and wetlands surrounding these rivers, harms the oceans into which these rivers flow, harm done to mountains harms the rivers flowing through them, harm done to oceans harms everyone directly or indirectly connected to them. That you cannot argue with physics. If you burn carbon-based fuels, this carbon will go into the air and have effects in the real world. That creating and releasing poisons into the world will poison humans and non-humans. That no one, no matter how rich or powerful, should be allowed to create poisons for which there is no antidote. That no one, no matter how rich or powerful, should be allowed to create messes that cannot be cleaned up. That no one, no matter how rich or powerful, should be allowed to destroy places humans or non-humans need to survive. That no one, no matter how rich or powerful, should be allowed to drive human cultures or non-human species extinct. That reality trumps all belief systems. What you believe is not nearly so important as what is real. That on a finite planet, you cannot have an economy based on or requiring growth. At least you cannot have one and expect to either have a planet or a future. That the current way of life is not sustainable and will collapse. The only real questions are what will be left of the world after that collapse and how bad things will be for the humans and non-humans who come after. We hold it as self-evident that we should do all that we can to make sure that as much of the real physical world remains intact until the collapse of the current system, and that humans and non-humans should be as prepared as possible for this collapse. That the health of local economies are more important than the health of the global economy. That a global economy should not be allowed to harm local economies or land bases. That corporations are not living beings. They are certainly not human beings. That corporations do not in any real sense exist. They are legal fictions. Limited liability corporations are institutions created explicitly to separate humans from the effects of their actions, making them by definition inhuman and inhumane. To the degree that we desire to live in a human and humane world, and really to the degree that we wish to survive, limited liability corporations need to be eliminated. That the health of human and non-human communities is more important than the profits of corporations. We hold it as self-evident, writes Derek Jensen, as the Declaration of Independence states that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. Further, we hold it as self-evident that it would be more precise to say that it is not the right of the people, nor even their responsibility, but instead something more like breathing, something that if we fail to do, we die. That's beautiful. If we as people fail to rid our communities of destructive institutions, those institutions will destroy our communities. And if we in our communities cannot provide meaningful and non-destructive ways for people to gain food, clothing, and shelter, then we must recognize it's not just specific destructive institutions, but the entire economic system that is pushing the natural world past its breaking points. Capitalism is killing the planet. Industrial civilization is killing the planet. Once we've recognized the destructiveness of capitalism and industrial civilization, both of which are based on systematically converting a living planet into dead commodities, we've no choice, unless we wish to sign our own and our children's death warrants, but to fight for all we're worth and in every way we can to overturn it. Amen and hallelujah. Now, I've got some emails coming on here, and we're going to go to those, but... maybe you guys can sense where I'm going with this tonight, okay? We have an email from Ryan Elise. I've been a member of CollapseNet for several months now, and I must say that I really, really enjoy it. On a separate note, having just survived the recent blackouts near Seattle, I just want to let you know how well your advice worked. I found out firsthand that we survive better as a community than as rugged individuals. Over the summer, I made preparations, like you said. First, I procured hard assets. I stocked up as appropriate for my surroundings, and when the power went out, things got a little bit colder. But other than that, life was pretty good. Once I found myself on solid footing, I reached out to my neighbors. Again, just like you said, I started building people connections as one of my assets. With no more or less than anything, planting any other gift of nature, I noticed that during this power outage, those relationships began to bear fruit. It wasn't that I needed help from them, just that I was in the position to have a better quality of life. In fact, I ended up helping them more than they helped me. It's really encouraging to see your advice working out in the wild. Cheers, Michael. Thank you so much for that. Yes, and it's happening and it's working, and it's like it's happening all over the place. And it's not just all my fault. There's like hundreds of us who have been out here for decades trying to bring this about and being prepared for this minute. And I'm sure that everybody who has worked so hard in transition or in the peak oil movement to try and reach people, thank you for letting us know that that our efforts have borne some fruit. And yes, it really is good to live this way, and it really is a joyous experience. From Kevin Okabe, who writes, hi, Mike, I live in L.A., and I grow tomatoes outside in containers. They're still growing, though not bearing, and I fully anticipate they will survive the winter. Two questions about this. Is this unusual for L.A. in winter? Also, can I expect these plants to bear fruit come spring and summer? As for the injustice, I write an innocent man named Eric Frimpong, who was convicted of raping a girl who had... Whoa, I've got to read this first. Okay. He's assisting someone who's about to be deported. I just didn't want to go into that into that part of that. Let me deal with the tomatoes. That's a little bit easier rather than doing something a little more sensitive on the air like that. From what I know about tomatoes, they can be finicky. I don't know what kind of soil you have them in, and it depends how long they've been planted. What you want to do is keep them exposed to as much sun as possible and give them support to grow vertically. And let them grow up. I mean, if they're tomato plants, they should probably figure out the rest. I hadn't grown tomatoes in L.A., Kevin. But that's about the best I can offer. Maybe somebody will send in a better answer than I was able to give there. Okay, so I want to go back. This hour has just raced through. So we had this big discussion that I've been weaving. And the issue is violence versus nonviolence. And the issue is how, where, and when, and how do we adopt. And I want to be very clear that as long as I'm involved with Occupy, and when I'm doing anything Occupy, it is an oath of honor for me that I will remain absolutely nonviolent. Many of us are willing to do this before, but if I have to go out again with Occupy and stand there and take the batons, take the fire hoses, take the gas, take the beating, whatever, that's my role in that moment at that time. I cannot say, given the gravity of the situation on this planet, that our battle will be won without fighting, without bloodshed. For quite frankly, I think that's kind of laughable to hope for that. And at some point, it may be necessary to fight. And I do not know whether I will die getting beat up by cops, being quote-unquote a martyr, which is a role that I do not seek, or whether I will die with a rifle in my hand. I would much rather die at a very old age with a very beautiful woman in my arms in bed with a big smile on my face. But I read a beautiful line this week. I'm reading a spiritual book that a friend gave me for a birthday present called Awareness by a Jesuit, Anthony de Mello, and a Jesuit mystic. And I'm not Catholic, but mystics, we communicate with each other. And there was this beautiful line that de Mello wrote. He said, "You come to a place in your life, some of us do, where the choices either go absolutely, irrevocably, totally crazy, insane, or become a mystic." So as I look ahead into what's coming for us, and it's coming for us very, very quickly now, is that the mystic in me says is that it is my hope that whatever I do, it will be of service to the victory. To the victory of our way of life, to the death of the infinite growth monetary paradigm, to the beast that has enslaved us, that I hope that whatever I wind up doing, I watch myself doing. Spiritually, a lot of spiritual people I've known along the way, we all have an attitude that after a certain point, you just sit back and watch the movie of your life and don't forget to eat popcorn. But it is my mission, and it is my objective as a warrior and one who tries to live in honor, to have myself in the position so that when I see how I'm reacting, that I can feel confident that that something bigger than me is moving, and not fear, and not self, or anything else. We serve something greater. And in this amazing play that I saw this week called Civil Disobedience the Musical, you got to check this out. I'm sure it's going to have a life. What I saw was that we are all woven together, that the children hear us, that our message is living, and even though there is great insanity coming, there is reason to hope, and we have something to hold on to. This is Mike Rupert, and I'll be back with you next week on the Lifeboat Hour. Good night.